Hey, Book Circle Online, welcome to the Comic Book Exchange. On this episode, we're going to be breaking down the first six issues of Image Comics' Skybound series, Outcast. Let's do it.
This is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Book Circle Online. Here, this is the Comic Book Exchange. We're going to be breaking down some of the most favorite new comic books coming out, some old favorites, some new favorites, talking to creators, talking about everything under the sun here. I'm one of your hosts, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter at HappyGoJackie, and just saw Suicide Squad, so we'll talk about that in just a second.
Well, I'm Lucretia Lyon, guys, and you can always find me at LACRETIALYON anywhere on the internet, since there is only one.
And I am Lex Michael, and I will have the Book Circle jingle stuck in my head for the rest of the day. You can find me all over social media at the Lex Michael.
Now, as I said at the intro there, we're going to be breaking down the first six issues of Robert Kirkman's Outcast. We'll be doing that in just a moment. But just around the horn, we'll do a quick sampling here of some of the things that have caught our eye in the comic book world. First off, Suicide Squad. That came out last week.
I finally had a chance.
Yes. Quick thoughts?
After you.
Yeah, we saw it opening night last Thursday, and at first I was really angry. And then I thought about it, and I'm like, you know what? It's not a comic book movie. So, you know, it doesn't have, like, plot and things like that that make sense, but it is an action movie with comic book characters. So if I thought about it like I would think about a Jason Statham movie, I gave it a B.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would give it a B. Where I come down on it,
I'm nice.
For me, honestly, and this is why I'm having such a hard time talking about this movie, there is so much in it that I really enjoy. So I think the cast is great, the characters for the most part work really well, and there are so many really excellent moments, especially if you know the source material. Mm-hmm. There are moments in this movie that I found to be incredibly satisfying. The problem for me is the way the movie hangs together, which is to say it barely does at all. This feels very much like a lumbering patchwork Frankenstein of an edit, which is appropriate because that's apparently exactly what it is. As a movie fan, it's hard for me to recommend this to anyone, really. But as a comic book fan, as a fan of the source material, as somebody for whom so many of those moments did work so, so well, I had a lot of fun with it, and I would really, really like to see a lot of these characters. Again, I'd love to see Will Smith's Deadshot, Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn, even Leto's Joker, who I thought was fine. Maybe overhyped, but fine. Love to see them again in a movie where they don't get bombarded with notes from on high that leads them to chop the movie up later.
Yeah, that's. I felt like watching this film, it wasn't like Batman vs. Superman. I think it really tweaked me more, only because I have so much more of an investment in those characters. And though I love the Suicide Squad, especially John Ostrander's and Luke McDonald's original series from DC Comics, love that. That's a whole great, like, 66-issue run that's just phenomenal from beginning to end. This one, I just felt it was very mediocre. And so I couldn't, like, I was watching, I was like, yeah, okay. Okay, yeah. And yeah, I didn't need to see Deadshot show again and again and again why he's Deadshot. Like, yeah. We get it.
You know what it is? It's not even like Will Smith is crazy charismatic, and you know, of course, when they're putting Deadshot in the movie, you know there's going to be a lot of fancy gunplay, and so that aspect of it, I was like, yeah, totally, this is what I expected. It's the fact that both Deadshot and Harley are introduced into the movie no fewer than three times each.
Yes.
That I was like, that, why? But it's the issue with the edit, and the edit feeling a bit confused.
Yeah, because to me, there were so many other characters they could have focused on in their, you know, second and third time of introducing them. Because to me, Killer Croc was one that I, you know, being that he pretty much replaced King Shark so they could make it an easier, more, like, you know, grounded character, to say the least, if they were going to have a fun one. But yeah, it's like, to me, with Killer Croc, I was like, I want to hear more. This is funny. You know, it reminded me of, like, the Batman the Animated Series. And that's the thing is, like, there were a lot of cartoony moments, not so, like, movie moments, but they at least were enjoyable.
All right, so that was our thoughts about Suicide Squad there. Now, before we get into Outcast, one quick thing that you've read this week that you think fans should keep an eye out for. I'll start us off here. I just read Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips' new series, Kill or Be Killed, from Image Comics.
How is that?
Very cool. It has a lot of similarities to Outcast, where there's just something else going on, but it's a really cool hook for this series. So keep an eye out for that if you see that at your comic book shop or online. The Creation?
Well, I've started to poke around Credence by Michael Easton, as most of you may know from General Hospital, One Life to Live, or even Port Charles. He's a soap actor, but he is a great graphic novelist. I've just started to peek into the Credence series, and it's pretty cool, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So I obviously have been catching up on Outcast, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. In between issues of Outcast, I finally got around to starting the third installment in the Dark Knight Returns trilogy, Dark Knight 3, The Master Race. I am now, I believe I'm caught up. I believe there are only 5 issues in. And I gotta say, I'm into it. It's, you gotta make a lot of the same leaps that you had to, even more so than with Dark Knight Returns, with Dark Knight Strikes Again. These really big, like, you have to have an elastic view of what these characters can be and what they maybe should or should not be doing. But as another installment in that universe, I really enjoy it, and it's a little bit more consistent as far as style than Dark Knight Strikes Again, because if you remember, he was writing, like, Frank Miller was writing and drawing that book, and I believe about halfway through the production of that series is when 9/11 happened, and you watch as you read the series, Dark Knight Strikes Again, knowing that, you watch Frank Miller go absolutely insane trying to process this absolutely horrible thing, this real-world tragedy that happened, and you see some of that anger, that frustration, that confusion coming out of the mouths of characters like Superman, and it's a little bizarre, but it works. This one is a little more unified as far as it doesn't quite go. There's not page after page of explosion of color out of nowhere, but it's pretty cool. The general premise has to do with the residents of the Bottle City of Kandor becoming full size again, and it turns out they're maybe not the nicest guys. I'm actually really digging it. So very I would cool. recommend that.
All right. So look at that. 3 great recommendations there for you to do either online or go to your local comic shop, find out some of those. But now we're going to do a little deep dive into the first 6 issues of Image Series Outcast. Created by writer Robert Kirkman, who you may know from The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. Invincible, Super mm-hmm. Dinosaur, Battle Pope. He's also done work for Marvel as well throughout the years, but now he's over here doing his own little wing of Image Comics called Skybound Studios there. Skybound Comics, excuse me. So that one of their first series was Walking Dead. Then he did Thief of Thieves, then Outcast, I believe was the order of that that went. So Outcast. If you're a Walking Dead fan, you already kind of enjoy Robert Kirkman's little foray into sort of more of the horror elements here. But this is more of a supernatural, kind of maybe more of a exorcist type delve into that sort of thing. So going into this, before you started reading this, did the idea of the series kind of hook you just on the premise alone, or did you like, I'm not really a huge kind of devil exorcism type fan?
Well, knowing my background in comics is like, you know, Hellblazer, Preacher, yes. stuff like that, this is my forte, and I was introduced to the comic, you know, when we do the after show for the show, which has been amazing. And what really hooks me, you know, into the comic is how just very much like the show it is. And that's really cool, because I know a lot of times they don't really stick to it, they veer off, but, you know, so far it's very similar, and you're getting like a little bit of differences, like say with Chief Giles, he's played by Reggie Cathy, so he obviously doesn't look like, you know, he does in the book, but yeah, I mean, most everything else is just spot on, which is really cool.
I obviously, like everybody, I'm familiar with The Walking Dead. I am not caught up in the comics, but I watch the show, and I enjoy it. I don't consider myself as intense a fan as, say, you know, there are a lot of that's got a very strong, big, passionate fan base. I'm not necessarily as into it as a lot of other people, but I'm of course, very aware of it's one of the biggest things in television right now. It was the show that turned me on to the comics, the show Outcast, which obviously they're about to hit the end of their first season. And the subject matter is something that I find myself a fan of frequently in film. I have not delved too deeply into that many horror comics, the more I'm thinking about it. But this is a concept that, you know, obviously I'm a huge fan of. I mean, The Exorcist is one of the greatest horror movies ever made. This deals with some of the same surface level subject matter. But what I also thought was insanely cool as I started to watch the show and then look into the comics, and I wanted to get your guys' take on this as well, it reads to me like they're using this demonic possession as a placeholder for a lot of different things, but among them, you know, depression or, you know, abuse or, you know, violent behavior in the home, and they use this demonic possession as a stand-in for, like, why is this person that I care about behaving in such a monstrous way and doing these monstrous things? And I thought that's a really cool, interesting angle that I'm sure somebody in the past has thought to go in that direction. But I personally have not seen it explored so thoroughly and from so many different angles. And I was really, really impressed by that.
That's true, because when you think about more of like the possession type films, you usually kind of go really to the extreme. Somebody gets possessed and they start acting cuckoo bananas. And this, people do, their personalities do change, but it varies from person to person. Some are a little bit more subtle, and some are just a little bit more outright demonstrative in terms of their cruelty and their evilness and propensity for doing bad things to other people around them.
Yeah.
So as we're saying, like, this is actually, they started this comic book series first. Now it's on Cinemax. They've been doing the first season. It's going to be wrapping up this week, correct?
Yes.
Sunday, yeah, is the finale.
Sunday is the finale. So I have not watched the series. I've only read the comic. So it'll be interesting to talk about it from different perspectives there of how we're approaching the source material. So as it goes in for the first six issues, just real quickly for the season, is it kind of coming up, would you say it's kind of sticking close to the first six issues, or have they gone kind of farther than the six issues that we're going to be talking about today?
A little bit further. Yeah, I believe it. You know, I think about the end of the first 12 is about where we are in this series.
Yeah, we're about caught up with the second arc of issues. I want to say issue 10, 11, 12, around that neighborhood. But it's interesting, too, the way for the series and adapting the comic, they do certain things as far as expanding time, collapsing time. So there are events that will be the span of an episode in the series, but it's three issues in the comic. And there will obviously be there's more to do for the supporting cast in the series, because I think in the book, the POV is very much you're with Kyle and you're with Reverend Anderson the entire time. And pretty much everything that you see is from the point of view of one of those two characters, and you're not getting much time with or much perspective on the supporting cast that's not directly through their eyes. Whereas you've got this wonderful cast of actors that they brought on to play all these roles in the show, so you get to see them have a little bit more to do. You get to see them have their own side stories that don't necessarily tie directly into what Kyle and Anderson are doing.
Nice. So as we kind of break into the first episode, if you look at compared to Kirkman's approach with Walking Dead, we basically just wake up when Rick does. And, I mean, the zombie outbreak has already happened. I mean, it's we're pretty much like in media res when that thing starts. This one, kind of a slower start. Certainly things have happened to our main protagonist, Kyle. But it's kind of more of a slow burn as we kind of figure out more of his backstory and what's happened to him. So does either approach, do you appreciate either one? Or are you like, I like either way as an entry point into a story?
Yeah, to me, it's just like the flashback aspect. You know, we learn about, you know, Kyle's mom, and this is sort of, you know, explaining as it goes through the first arc here. But yeah, with Rick, you know, waking up and then the zombie apocalypse already happening, like, to me, either way seems to work. Like, whether we're building up and sort of getting into, or just, hey, shit's already hit the fan.
Yeah. It's interesting because I am now, it's been such a long time since I've read the first couple issues of Walking Dead. I'm remembering the series. It's basically the series. He wakes up and then you get this gradual, like, what's going on until the reveal, oh, it's zombies, ah! And then everything is just horrifying from there on out. The series, Outcast, both the television series and in the comics, the first, like, event is almost immediate. You meet Joshua and his mom almost immediately, and almost immediately it's like, okay, but little boy's biting his fingers off, something's not right. And then we go to Kyle and we get back to this slight slow burn, but we actually get that first, oh goodness, moment a lot earlier, which I think is a great way to you basically do both. You basically have it both ways. You get to do your slow burn with your protagonist, but you get to open with this boom, this shocking, inciting incident that keeps you going like, all right, I'll sit through this slow burn with Kyle and figure out what's going on here, because at some point we got to get back to, like, finger-eating boy and see what's happening over there. So I think it works. I think it's a great way to have it both ways.
Yeah, and what was really cool is the show did the same thing, starting out with Joshua and freaking out, but they made it, you know, even more graphic, as they do, because it's on Cinemax. They have Joshua smashing his head into the wall to smash a bug. Mm. And that's something we really don't see too much in the comics. It was just really the eating the finger moment. But I'm like, they had to add a little bit of gore for TV.
Yeah. The thing that always kind of bugs me about possession stories is that invariably it seems like only maybe like the priest and maybe one other hero buys what's happening, and then nobody else goes like, possession, whatever. And never until at the very, very end, somebody starts buying it, and then they usually get killed off.
Well, and it's, so to your point, exactly, there are so many of these stories where we're meant to believe that, you know, this is the exorcism that this story is about, but, you know, there have been whispers, this type of thing's been going on in this town for years. And like, okay, if this type of thing has been going on in this town for years, why is literally no one going, yeah, this is totally weird. This is a bizarre thing. So one of the things I love about Outcast and the way they're choosing to tell the story is, yes, you've got Kyle and you've got Reverend Anderson, and they're very much on the forefront of this fight against whatever this malevolent force is. But you also have a certain number of supporting characters, the police chief, Giles, being one in particular, who's A, been in this town long enough, and B, he's known Reverend Anderson long enough to know that even though he hasn't seen it, and even though to him it sounds insane, there is definitely something up. And it's nice because in a lot of horror stories, in any medium, your supporting cast ain't always populated with the smartest and most observant of people. Mm-hmm. So it's that aspect of it, for me, was very, very refreshing.
Yeah, because with the people of Rome, you have, like, you know, Betsy, first thing she does about Joshua is call Reverend Anderson. Hey, didn't you stop this before? And then, you know, later in this arc, you meet Mildred, who he had exorcised before, but is obviously, you know, not without her demon inside her anymore. And the thing is even at the poker game, you see how Chief Giles and, you know, Reverend Anderson are just around the table kind of talking about it, you know? It's like it's, that's just the way it is. He performs exorcisms.
That's true. And, yeah. And in fact, I like the introduction that we have for Reverend Anderson in this, where it just starts off with he's playing poker and he's basically telling everybody that people are born believers, we're made this way, we want to trust, and we want to have faith, but he still, as much as he believes that, he still has a feeling that his side's losing. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I always just like the introduction of a reverend that's kind of like a more casual kind of reverend. I mean, he'll still play, he'll gamble, he'll drink, he'll smoke. He's not exactly completely pious, which I like that. It's a more refreshing take on Pete.
Yeah, Reverend Anderson is actually probably my favorite character in the book because he's just so matter of fact. And I mean, he's also a tad blasphemous. I mean, you see the way he talks. He says, God damn, he smokes, he drinks, he's playing poker. I mean, that's the thing, is this is a guy that at least people can relate to. He's not too pious, as you said.
He is. He's an incredibly human character, and he is incredibly fallible, which makes him, like Lucretia, I agree completely, makes him so much more relatable than the priest character in these types of stories tend to be. Normally, it's the guy, you know, it's like, somebody's possessed, we gotta call the Vatican, and they send in, like, Max von Sydow or Tom Wilkinson, and it's very, like, the power of Christ, but stay over there. You must not. You know, there's a big gap in interaction between the holy man figure and the for lack of a better way of putting it, the common people, the non-religious folk. Whereas in this story, Reverend Anderson is so one of the people. He's so one of his own flock, and it's great because, yes, it makes him a guy that we can immediately connect to, but that fallibility is also it ultimately is what leads to his unraveling, in a way, by the end of even these first six issues. So much of what happens to him, and yes, you can obviously point the finger at the malevolent Sydney pulling a lot of strings, absolutely, but it is Anderson's own very human impulses, these weaker human impulses, these quick moves to anger, or to irrationality, or to aggressiveness, that seem to undercut what he's trying to accomplish just as often, if not more so, and it makes for a fascinating dynamic.
Well, I think it's easy for somebody to say live this way, but it's hard. It's hard to, I think, incredibly difficult to be a priest in these times and just try to kind of be that moral kind of high ground. I think that's really hard to do in these days and times. I think there's so much more of a gray area now that, I mean, you've got to be able to operate within those and can still be you know, somebody that can be sought out for guidance and for inspiration and aspiration, but you know, you do have your moments of fallibility as well.
Yeah, and that's why I love when you do see the scene of him in the church and he's giving his sermon. He's pretty much talking about, yeah, we're all failures. You know, none of us are going to live up to this. Let's just, you know, try to be good. You know, he's not even, like, setting people up for failure.
Now, one other, as we meet Kyle, we see that he's just trapped basically in the past. I mean, he's still living in the home that he grew up in, that everything that's happened in his life leading up to that point, everything went down inside that house. Just a lot of personal demons plaguing that house.
We talk so frequently on the after show for the Cinemax series Outcast, specifically about just how brutally terrible Kyle's life is, about how it seems to have been terrible for a very long time, is currently terrible, and the more time we spend with him, the worse it seems to get.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
One little bright spot, though, seems to be his quote-unquote sister, Megan.
Yes.
And it's always nice when you have family or that person that no matter what happens, they are not going to let you out of their lives that easily. They're going to grab onto you and just hold you tight no matter how much you want them to be away from you. For whatever reason, especially for Kyle, his own personal reasons. He's like, hey, you know, I've got a lot of stuff that's gone down. please, just for your own sake, just stay away.
Yeah, because he fears for Megan's safety as well as Holly and even Mark's to an extent, their family. He doesn't want to be around them since of what happened about his family. And what I love, though, is Megan is such the big sister role more than anything, especially with the solid poop line, which they kept for the show, which was fun. Yeah.
I also really enjoy that their relationship is, it's their brother and sister, and we never question it because they never question it. They treat it completely as a given. But you learn a little bit more about the way they grew up, and it was a house where, you know, Megan's parents would basically take in kids. So I like the idea that there's an actual active desire for the two of them to be in each other's lives that isn't necessarily dictated by a blood relationship, which is something that I think it makes that connection even stronger, because you can, you know, different families have different dynamics, but at least on paper, ideally, there's this idea of, well, if somebody's your family, yeah, you're stuck with them.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the case here, and they are still there for each other implicitly, and I really like that.
Yeah, because you learn, you know, in these first six issues about Donnie, who was another kid that her parents took in, but he wasn't like Kyle, and Kyle even protected Megan as much as he could from this evil guy, Donnie, that, you know, still seems to be wanting to hang around. And
Donnie's a jerk.
I know.
Donnie's, doesn't matter which version of Outcast you dive into, Donnie is a jerk.
Well, as Megan and Kyle are talking there, and she's trying to get him to just get out of the house, at least for an hour, we cut over to Joshua's exorcism by good old Reverend Anderson. And this exorcism, of course, it's always like the mom, you know, as much as like, oh, I want you to take care of my son. But then it always seems like the mom just wants to come in and just interrupt. It's always that way. Like, I just want to take a peek. Can I help? Oh, you're hurting my son. I felt like the first time you glimpse of this exorcism that, unlike other exorcisms that we've seen before, I mean, this is certainly, it takes a very much of a violent physical turn, and that you can just see that whatever is inside Joshua just appreciates just kind of that brutality. Mm.
There is a lot to discuss and unpack when it comes to, because you just referenced this force inside Joshua that seems to really get into this brutality aspect. Yeah, first of all, yes, absolutely. But there is a lot to unpack there as far as this evil that they're actually fighting, because it is so much more, my reading of it anyway, so much more complex than what we typically see in these stories. And these stories, it is very black and white, right? Whoever they go to exorcise is possessed by a demon. Demon is a direct tie to the devil and or is the devil itself. Very black and white. We're righteous. This is evil. Let's fight it. Whereas there seems to be a lot more going on, and we still don't, you know, we're almost to the end of the first season of the TV series. The comic book is now on issue 18, I believe. Mm-hmm. We're still parsing out information about what's actually the agenda here, what's the motivation. Are these guys like the devil as we typically understand them? Like, what is happening here? But we know that there's a variety of personalities they seem to have.
Yeah, that would probably be, certainly, I know we're only talking about the first six issues, but looking for everything that the series as a whole, up to issue 18 so far, I feel one of my frustrations with it is that there's still so much unknown. And it's kind of like, I wish we had a little bit more just sense of the ground rules to understand how this world operated. We don't have to answer all the questions, but just a better understanding of how because there's a wide variety of ways people are possessed, how they're affected by Kyle, that it just seems like it just varies from person to person. And I'd love to just be able to establish, like, this is just the baseline of what's going on.
Yeah, unfortunately, so far, even, you know, watching the show, we still don't have a good clue about that, and which is interesting because especially in this first six issues, you see Joshua, Blake, Mildred, and Sydney, who are these possessed beings, but vastly different people, and Allison a little bit in there.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, if you watch the series as a companion piece to the comics, you get slightly different, not contradicting, but slightly different pieces of information from both. And I assume that the information that you have from one source and not the other, you'll get the longer the story goes and vice versa. We're at a point now, and we can talk a little bit more about it as we get further into the run of Outcast, obviously, because they don't hit on too much of it too specifically in the first six issues. But we can start talking about, you know, the further you get, it starts to take shape a little bit. We don't quite know what they're doing here. We know they talk very early on in the series about a merging event. We know they're preparing for something that's coming. We know some of them are concerned they're not going to make it through this event, but we don't know exactly where they come from. You know, Reverend Anderson is incredibly, he's a reverend, he's a very religious man, so he treats this as a fight against the devil. But really, if you think about it, there's nothing outside of the iconography of the series, because obviously you've got a priest and you've got the religious iconography surrounding him, and you've got the end of these first six issues. Sidney carves the pentagram into his chest, which is horrifying. But really, if you think about it, there's nothing in these first six issues besides the characters themselves that really tell us conclusively this is even, like, the devil. This is even, for all we know, this is, like, aliens or something. But that's why I think it's so fascinating that we're getting what's on the surface very similar to a traditional possession narrative. But it is so, the more layers you peel back, it is so much more intricate, and there's so many more moving parts, which I think is super cool.
Yeah, because with Sidney, he leads Reverend Anderson to believe he is the devil, with just, but not without right saying. It's like, yeah, I've been known by many names, you know, stuff like that, in carving the pentagram. But at the same time, Sidney, you know, as we'll later learn, is a little bit, you know, evil in a way, and more intricate in thinking about these things, that may just be so he'd screw with Reverend Anderson.
That's true. As we start to learn more about Cal's character, though, while Megan takes him home, so we meet Mark and Molly for the first time, Holly, and learn about that. Oh, wait. Kyle did something to his daughter. Hurt his daughter somehow. Mm-hmm. His wife's no longer in the picture, so everybody's looking at Kyle as like some kind of sort of a monster in the community. Like, he's done a terrible thing to his wife and daughter, and they are no longer with him. And that's kind of feel like you can feel him. He's just kind of devastated by this, the shell of his life that it is right now. And I feel like that's what sort of the first issues that you kind of figure out what's really the true story about what happened with Kyle and Allison and their daughter that night that everything went down in that house.
And he's at a point where we first meet him, where because of these events that have taken place, that we start to learn more about very, very gradually, the more other characters are talking to him, to each other about it. He's at this place where he's completely adrift because he is cut off from his daughter, from his wife. And he's got a relationship with Megan still, certainly, but he's so withdrawn that even Megan has a hard time getting through to him. All he really has is this, I have to stay where I'm at. I have to stay put. I can't leave this dilapidated empty house because I still need to be near my family, because he knows something happened. He knows that these forces exist without being able to prove it to anybody. So then, of course, along comes Reverend Anderson and pulls him into this, and suddenly it gives him purpose. It gives him something to do. And he not aggressively, but is resistant to it a little bit at first, because I think Kyle, he knows what's up, but I think he doesn't think he's the guy. I don't think he thinks he's the guy to fight that particular fight.
Yeah, because it feels like he doesn't really want to acknowledge that really went down with his mom or anything until he gets in the room with Joshua, and Joshua, or whatever's inside Joshua, recognizes him. And not necessarily by name, but just calls him outcast. So for some reason, he has some recognition of Kyle and what he's capable of.
And that's something, too, that I noticed they hit a little bit harder in the comic book than they do in the series. Because they refer to him as outcast a couple of times. But I'm feeling like in the book, it's a couple of times, almost a couple of times per issue, if we're talking to one of these demons. And it comes up a lot more frequently.
Yeah, and we see we get to see the exorcism in full force this time, where basically, it just gets incredibly violent. I mean, and it's something to see, having not seen the series, but seeing a grown man start striking a young child to get rid of the demon that's inside of him, man.
It's quite a piece of television.
Yeah.
And it's quite a piece of comic book storytelling as well, because obviously you don't get the impact of watching the violence happen in real time as it would if you were watching a filmed adaptation, certainly. But it is brought so sharply and vividly to life by this creative team in a way that, and I mean this as a compliment, that is downright ugly and disturbing. In the first couple of pages, they're able to hit this tone that they're going for, dead like bullseye and like hard.
Yes, and it's, of course, we've talked about Robert Kirkman being the creator and writer there, but then part of the team that's behind that, Paul Aceveda doing the artwork on there, Russ Wooten with the lettering, Elizabeth Breitweiser doing the coloring, all of it working really well. I mean, Paul Aceveda, man, that panels and the coloring and everything just comes together really nicely to execute Robert Kirkman's script in this.
Yeah, and it's a great looking book. When the word ugly, I should clarify, I'm referring to the tone and not to the art. The art it's gorgeous. I mean, it's a gorgeous book, and it does put you right there. The way it is drawn gives a sense, I felt a sense of immediacy that makes the violence feel violent in a way that, for me, even, you know, there are certain comic books that you can pick up that have a lot of very violent imagery in them, But the immediacy of these images makes it feel more real and more visceral and more impactful than I'm used to seeing, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah, I mean, punching a young child in the face to exorcise the demon is, I mean, in itself darkness, but just the way that they go over it and you realize the blood is the key and you're like, oh, wow. And yes. Then Betsy's just, nah, it's fine.
So we do find out that Kyle does find out the key is blood seems to drive out whatever is inside young Joshua, and he's fine. Problem doesn't really have much of a memory of it there. And Betsy, Joshua's mom, she's going to cover it up with the police because he just fell down the stairs. That's all that happened. Yeah, sure.
A lot. Yeah, yeah, he fell down. And he landed on his fingers on the floor teeth that we have.
Yeah.
Yep, that's what happened.
And we feel like Mark is like, I'm going to keep an eye on you because I don't trust what went down, what's going on in here. But at least Kyle now has some sort of kind of motivation to try to get his life back, get Allison and get his daughter back in his life, finally figure out what really happened that night when Allison was completely possessed by whatever's inside there and they had a total knockdown, drag-out fight because he had to stop her from killing their daughter.
Yeah. And that experience just shut him down completely. And then, yeah, like you said, it's this experience with Joshua that finally shakes him out of his apathy a little bit.
Yeah, and as we get into the second issue, that's when we see Donnie introduced to the series.
Oh, Donnie.
Yeah, learn more about his backstory. And it's interesting to see Mark and appreciate Kyle's wanting to help out, beat up Donnie. They both do a little group beatdown on Donnie when they find out, like, oh, that's Donnie. Mark, that's Donnie. Donnie.
Bam! Yeah. Yeah.
And they certainly get to it way quicker in the book than they do the show, because it was several episodes until you see them come to that understanding and Mark find out about Donnie, which was interesting to me. Yeah.
The way they lay it out in the book, though, I love it. Probably the way they were telling the story in the series, I think it might have felt wonky if they did it exactly the same way. Yeah. I love in the book, Kyle sees Donnie and immediately just starts taking swings at him. Mark, being a police officer, shows up. He's like, whoa, what are you doing? Stop beating on this man. And Kyle's like, no, Mark, that's Donnie. And Mark goes,
okay.
Oh, and then starts beating the crap out of him himself. It's amazing.
And it is interesting when Mark and Kyle just have a chance to sit down, you can see that Mark's kind of, once he learns more about their backstory with Megan and Donnie and Kyle, that he has a tough time reconciling the man that's in front of him telling this that grew up with Megan to Allison, the man that he knows to put Allison in the hospital because they visited and saw what happened afterwards. So a tough time, like, how could somebody that was so kind and so helpful to Megan growing up turn into be like such a cruel person, even though he doesn't quite understand the full story?
It's nice, too, that you get Mark's POV, or you start to get more of Mark's POV a lot earlier because you don't get to spend time in the comic as much with him and Megan by themselves, whereas you don't get to that point with Kyle and Mark where they come to a place of a little more understanding until, Lucretia, probably like midpoint of the season, if not slightly later. But that's okay because you spend time with Mark and Megan, you get a little bit more information about who Mark is, so he's not... You know, you don't see him as an antagonist from Kyle's point of view, whereas you don't spend that time with him here. So I thought, of course, it makes a lot more sense that you've got to make it clear that he's an ally up front.
And I did like Megan and Mark's conversation, though, about after the fact, when she finds out what they did to Dinah, it's like, what makes you think that I would want you to do that? I like that she does not like tolerate that at all. Like, you've got a family to provide for. You can't be a dumb idiot going beating some guy, getting thrown in jail yourself. Then what do we do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's I don't want to keep going back to the show because we're talking about the books, but they have that basically a version of that same conversation after an even more epic beatdown happens with even greater potential ramifications. But it's played so wonderfully in the show. And again, I read the book afterwards, so I'm seeing things framed in a slightly different context. So it doesn't, that line didn't hit me quite as hard as it did in the context that it's delivered on the show, but I'm reading it and I'm going like, yeah, what an amazing way, since we don't spend that time alone with Megan and Mark, what an amazing way in one line to give us so much information about who Megan is and the type of relationship she has with her husband. I thought, like, that's smart writing.
One other character we do meet in the second issue, though, is Kyle's mom. We've heard a lot about her, but now we see her, and she's basically in a vegetative state in a hospital. And still, even in a hospital, as Kyle says, like, you're still finding ways to torment me even now. Because now he's kind of trying to figure out, like, well, how much of you was really you? How much of it was maybe something that was inside you that was a cause for you tormenting me throughout my childhood? But I feel like I need to try to figure out. Maybe you were trying to do something good. Maybe you were bad. I don't know what the deal is, but I'm going to try to find out what the answer is to this.
Yeah, Kyle's mom. Kyle's, I'm still... this poor, I mean, first of all, Kyle's life is awful. And I feel like this is a point that the more we talk about Outcast, the more that point will come up. It's just Kyle's life is just the worst. But yeah, his mom is in this catatonic state because after whatever it is that happened when he was younger, you know, and it's another situation where his mother was taken over by one of these malevolent entities. I always, my impulse is always to use the word demon. But again, we haven't really pinned down that these are demons necessarily. So they're like malevolent, possessing entities, which is really cumbersome to say. But so the demons, one of them possessed Kyle's mom. It was this horrible, traumatic, abusive scenario. And then somehow, and Kyle still doesn't quite understand how it happened, but he was able to get it out of his mom. But it seems to have taken his mom with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's something we discuss a lot on the after show for the show as well, is so there's a big difference in Joshua and Kyle's mom. So it's like, what is the difference? I mean, obviously, it's sort of the same sort of exorcism. You see the punching in the face, the blood has something to do with it. But is it the duration that it was inside her that made it different than say, well, Joshua's fine, then Kyle's mom is in this vegetative state? And that's something we still have yet to figure out.
And certainly by the end of that issue, we do find out, certainly Sydney, or the man in black, as I just keep calling him all the time, does go visit her in the hospital and just says, you know, hey, you put up a heck of a fight. Your son doesn't even know how much you fought. But, you know, tough nuts. We've got him. He's still got him. He's ours anyway, no matter what you do. And you see, like, the nice little tear, a little closer to the tear, just watering coming down her eyes right there in the hospital bed.
Which is interesting, too, and this is something that we haven't really come back to yet in the comics or on the series. That tear, because the end of the second episode of the show is that scene, is Sydney visiting his mother in the hospital, and it's that same interaction and ends with the tear as well. The conversation around some of these people who are possessed and are left in a similar state is what I was saying before. It seems like when this possessing entity left, it took that person with them. That tear, though, suggests to me anyway that at least something of Kyle's mom is still trapped in there and for whatever reason is unable to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're so unclear on what the rules are. So I don't know.
Exactly. And to me, it's just like, does it make it less sad that she's still in there or more sad being that she can't communicate and talk to Kyle and show him what's going on here? You know, it's like, you know, it's like, how sad is Kyle's life? That'd be a fun game show. Yeah.
When we get to issue 3, we introduce a character that I really enjoyed his introduction to the series, and that's Detective Luke Masters.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly his introduction into the series, not the most pleasant one. He's going out to go run some, get some medicine or something for his partner, who's not feeling very well, is staying there at their house. His wife, Teresa, sends Luke out to grab some stuff. And once he's gone, Blake makes a move on her. And
that's a way to, makes a move.
Yeah. And you feel like you get the idea that there's something going on there, despite whatever Blake's condition might be, that there is some sort of underlying sort of kind of, you know, tension or something, chemistry or connection between them. And they do have a kiss, and then he rips out her tongue. Good Lord.
like you do.
Ooh, yeah, that
yes.
happens.
But what I liked about that is, I mean, so basically he kills her, and Luke comes back to find out that, you know, he's basically covered in blood and kind of tauntingly, but then also then at the end, just very quietly saying, apologizing for this terrible act that he's done. So you're kind of wondering, like, how much of is the demon, how much of it is Kyle, or of Blake that is cognizant of what he did inside that house?
It seems a little bit like they come and go. Like, once the demon has settled, and yeah, I'm just going to default to using the word demon. I'm aware, maybe not the most apt term, but it's the first one that comes to mind. The demons, once they adjust, because there's a period of adjustment, right? Like, when the demon first lands, they're all crazy and unhinged and violent. Once the demon has been in the host for a little while, there seems to be an element of sometimes they're there, and sometimes they're not. Or maybe more accurately, sometimes they're driving, and sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
So I think they can take over, do something as awful and brutal as what Blake does, and then just, you know, put their feet up and hang out and watch for a little while as this person has to then grapple with the trauma of what they've done, which is so deeply disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Great, but so deeply disturbing.
Well, yeah, and then it's noted later by Kyle and Reverend Anderson that the entity or demon or whatever you will inside of Blake seems more powerful. And as you see, you know, Luke talks about there's not much of Blake left there. You know, he and Terry were close friends. This whole thing is absolutely nothing like him, which we're only seeing it from one character's perspective. But with Luke's perspective, as well as what they say, is this demon somehow more powerful than, say, what inhabited Cal's mom or Joshua? You know, and what is the difference here? Because obviously what Blake does is way more heinous than any of the other acts we see.
No, that's true. And what I did like about Luke is that somebody that's a cop that maybe that might have a natural predisposition to kind of believing in this, but does the research, does the investigation, looks back into Kyle's and Reverend Anderson's background, and is willing to make that leap. Like, all right, I think you guys, you know, if you've had some kind of experience with this, I think you can help me out in this. And I kind of really appreciated Luke's kind of research into this before he approached them.
Yeah, it was a very logical and well thought out way of bringing it in. So it's not just like, oh, just randomly heard this. No, he does his research, and it's obvious that this has been going on for a little while and time has passed, which I really hate that this is only one episode in the show and that we haven't seen a resurgent of Blake and Luke yet. But I do feel like we'll get to see them again because they were such interesting characters.
Yeah, and that's something that's worth pointing out. I mentioned up top how they expand time in certain areas for the show and collapse it in certain other areas. These three issues, all of this business with these detectives is one episode of the show.
Wow. It's a shame because I find Luke such an interesting character that I look forward to him coming back a little bit more in the series, having hopefully a more of an active role.
And a perfect example of what we were talking about before, of how I really appreciate how the supporting cast seems generally better informed and more proactive than in a lot of these stories. I wonder, too, if maybe instead of this character having more of a presence on the show, they expand Giles' role a little bit more on the show, and they make him a little bit more involved, a little bit more proactive.
Yeah, and so we find out, though, during the course of this, though, that, as Lucretia was saying, that all these, the possession is, it's not just cut and dry. And we've talked about, even Lexi Banks mentioned this a little earlier, it's not, everybody's not the same. It's not cookie-cutter possession. So it depends on, Kyle's blood is not as quite as effective this time. So he's like, it's not working this time as before. So there's a lot of stuff that we're still trying to figure out exactly what are the kind of rules and a way to exercise whatever entity is inside each of these individuals. There's no one quick solution to this, it seems to be.
Yeah, they just fly around the room and punch people and throw the blood and they hope for the best, but we don't know. And part of Anderson's whole journey is realizing that all this work that he's tried to do has maybe been completely, completely ineffectual. And now what?
Yeah, because they go back, because on their runs before Anderson agrees to help out Kyle with Blake, they do some errands and they end up meeting Mildred, the old lady that when Kyle does happen to accidentally touch her, she freaks out. Kyle begins to suspect that maybe she still has something inside her, and when they go back to kind of double-check it again, they come to the realization, like, Anderson says, I thought I freed her from this demon, and clearly she's not. So am I just a big failure? What's going on with me?
Yeah, and to me, that's actually one of the most interesting things about Anderson is, you know, the devastation he gets when he realizes, you know, he basically left his family for this, you know, cause that obviously didn't work. And, you know, and he's coming to terms with Kyle is the solution and not him. So it's really playing on his pride a little bit, which is really interesting and more fleshed out in the show. But yeah, the thing with Mildred is just like, even in the comic, feel the devastation in Reverend Anderson when he's like, she's still possessed.
And the crazy thing is this place that it puts Anderson into of questioning, legitimately questioning to his core, both have I wasted my life and have I completely misplaced my faith in God, represents about the happiest point that he gets in this story.
Yeah, there are times in here, in several issues there, where there's a moment like where he's shaving, or he's just sitting there, and he's looking so beat down by life that I thought he was going to kill himself. It just seemed like that was just like that. He was like, what am I doing? I'm like Sisyphus. I'm just going to just forget about it and get out of here. But no, they didn't go that direction, which is good, I mean, but because they want to keep him around.
But again, that puts him in this position of weakness, effectively, and it makes him, an easy target for the people that are actively, people like Sydney, that are actively looking to undo him. But it also makes him so much more vulnerable to his own worst impulses, which we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is, it's devastating to watch this poor man go through, but dang, it's compelling.
Not true. And as we wrap up the first six issues, we find out that Sydney's come to go visit him and let Anderson know, like, hey, you know, you're on the right track. You're learning a lot of knowledge that you shouldn't be learning, and you need to stop it. You need to keep Kyle out of this. And just to let you know, I mean business, I'm going to carve a pentagram on
into your chest.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I loved that part in the show. So when it comes up in the book, I was like, ooh, already? Like, and it was, because it's just such a huge F you to Anderson by Sidney, because he's like, I'm going to discredit you. You know, I am the devil. But as I say, I don't think he really is. I think he's just using that because he knows that's the way to get at Reverend Anderson.
And I love, like, what you just said. It happens a good deal sooner in the series than it feels like it happens in the comic series than it feels like it happens on the show. On the show, it feels like they've been going, Kyle and Anderson have been walking down this road for a little while. Sidney's been aware for a little while. He's been making ominous, thinly veiled threats for a little while. This is finally like, all right, they bridge too far. Now Sidney's got to step in and carve the pentagram. Whereas in the comic, it feels very much like Sidney's, almost like his opening salvo, like, hey, this is the first and the best thing that's going to happen if you keep walking down this road.
Yeah, and so while we leave our first 6 issues with kind of Anderson kind of at his lowest point, we see Kyle trying to at least take a step towards reclaiming his life, where there's been a room inside the house that he's been kind of reluctant to enter in the course of these first 6 issues. And finally, at the end of the 6th issue, he opens up the key to his room. That was his mom's bedroom. And you kind of basically see the night that everything went down with him and his mom, and that whatever entity was inside her finally leaving her body. And finally, Kyle's able to walk in that room and just say, like, all right, this is just an empty room. And that's where we kind of leave Kyle at the end of these first six issues. So where we're at right now in the series, how do you guys feel about it? Are you guys, I mean, you've seen the series, the TV show, so you're a little bit ahead of where the story is. But just in terms of the first 6 issues, captivating, compelling, makes you want to keep reading the series?
Oh, yeah, especially because, yeah, as I say, one of my favorite moments in the series was, you know, the Reverend Anderson-Sidney confrontation. So to get that early and you're just like, oh, what is next? Who is Sidney? So you're like really wanting to delve into more of these two characters for sure. And as I say, with Blake, you know.
Yeah, for me, ultimately, what it comes down to is, like, the easiest pitch for somebody who's never heard of Outcast before, everyone's heard of Walking Dead, right? So it's a demonic possession story from the guy who made Walking Dead. Easiest pitch, quickest pitch. They'll go, oh, okay, I get it. It is so much more complex and interesting and exciting than that. This is in no way a straightforward run-of-the-mill demonic possession story. There are so many really, like, juicy thematic strands that we could pull on, and I think we will the longer we talk about this series. I'm really excited to talk about some of the stuff that's coming up because they're... Oh, dude, like, it's a cool story.
It's interesting. It's a much more different tech than I've ever thought of, but I do wrestle as I read these issues even more from, like, 6 up to 18. Me wanting to know more information and me being like, why do you keep drawing out and belaboring certain points? This is kind of frustrating. So I'm at that mixture of, like, wanting to know more, but also frustrated at certain points. But still, it makes me want to keep reading and see where this is
right, so you're frustrated in, like, the best way.
Yeah, because certainly Robert Kirkman, he does long-form storytelling. Certainly, if you've seen The Walking Dead, it's 157 issues right now. So when he tells a story, he basically has a real long-term goal in mind. So you're not going to get everything right away.
Right.
It just, you know, it'd be nice to get a little something.
Yeah. Yeah, as I say, we're a little ahead, and we're like, yeah, they still don't explain that.
That's the thing is, like, the two of us right now could start dropping some spoilers, and real quick, we'd run out of spoiler stuff because we don't know that much more than you do.
No, and certainly it's very interesting to think about if you think about The Walking Dead, the TV series. Once they started, though, there was already so many issues of The Walking Dead. They were so far ahead of where the TV show is. Outcast, very close to where
they're at right now. We're almost caught up.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to be curious to see how these two mediums diverge as the series and the comic book series continue.
Absolutely.
How much they stay alike and how much they diverge. And for me, I don't feel like the need to be as beholden to the source material. I'd rather treat it as two different explorations of the same story.
The best is when you have two things that work great independently and also work great as companion pieces to each other, which so far seems to be the case with Outcast.
Now, do you feel a need that anything that's revealed here in the comic has to be true for the TV show and vice versa? Or can they have different revelations, different motivations for characters, different reasons for why things are happening in different mediums, and you're totally fine with two different kind of parallel stories?
Yeah, as someone compared to The Walking Dead, like, you know, certainly with the character of Carol and how that arc certainly changed in the show for the better, in my opinion, but the book is also still valid. It worked for that. I would be okay with Outcast doing that as well. It's just like, you know, like with Chief Giles, whether he joins them up or it's Luke, you know, later on, it doesn't matter. I mean, it seems to be working in the show pretty well versus, you know, I don't know if it'd work the same in the novel.
And I'm the type of person who, if I read the comic, I fall in love with the comic, and I go watch the TV series adaptation, or I go see the movie adaptation, every moment or line, or I'm like, that's right out of the comic, that's amazing. I get very excited the same way I think we all do if we love the source material, but there's no reason to be completely beholden to the source material if there are new and fun and exciting ways that you can explore angles of this world that lead you on a different path. And I think we'll probably start to see that a little more from the series just because of how much the supporting cast is given to do, because you have these wonderful actors and you want to give them a real good reason to show up to work every day, like something real good to sink their teeth into. I think we're going to start seeing it diverge a lot more in the future. And honestly, I'm all for that, because as long as the core DNA of the story is the same, then it's like, great, I can go over here and I can read the comic, I can go over here and watch the series, and I've got two amazing stories born of the same seed, and I can have all of it, and it's great, and I'm happy.
Awesome. All right. And one last moment that I did like is Kirkman. It seems to be great in just fleshing out a character in just a few lines, few scenes. And Kyle's neighbor, we didn't really talk about in the course of our breakdown.
Yeah,
of the series. Yes. Just their little conversation there about marriage and life and stuff like that. Just so nice. And interesting play by Sidney to be able to, which I did like. It wasn't a malevolent thing when he kind of takes over and assumes the identity of his brother. It's like, oh, I'm his brother. He passed away in his sleep, which I thought was nice. Like, don't make it malevolent. Don't make it mysterious how he died or anything. It's like, he was old. He passed away in his sleep. I thought that was a smart move on Sidney's part.
They put a little finer point on it in the show. It's a little less ambiguous what happened in Northfield.
Oh, really?
But same result.
Well, I like to think that he went away peacefully in his sleep. Don't tell me otherwise, guys. Do not.
We won't ruin it for you.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for our breakdown of the first six issues of Outcast. But we'll be back next week breaking down issues 7 through 12. So join us. Go ahead and read those if you didn't have a chance to. Jump in the chat. We'll have the chat going next week. You guys can chime in about your thoughts and opinions. If you have questions about the series, throw them out. We'll answer them. Lucretia always has her laptop here. She always has a chat open. We're ready to answer all your questions. So please, like us on Facebook, subscribe to us there on iTunes, give us those 5 stars. You can also subscribe to the YouTube channel, hop in the chat, continue the conversation with us on Twitter, even after the show is over. But you know what we're going to do? We're going to tease before we get that, because that's like we're going to tease you with a little bit of news. Why not?
Yeah. Why not? Let's turn news in.
Yes.
I'm having a good time. Yeah, let's keep the party going.
Look at that. I was so quick to end, but look at that. We're going to be like that little bonus little section that you get. You turn the credits and all of a sudden, hey, wait, there's a little post.
We're like a Marvel movie.
A little epilogue.
Yeah. If you're the type of person that turns off your podcast as soon as they start wrapping up, you're going to miss some things.
Wow.
Well, the first thing we'll talk about there is Aaron Kruder. An artist there, most recently known for doing a lot of stuff with Grant Morrison.
Yes.
Yes, over with his work with Batman Incorporated.
Kruder.
Yeah, Kruder.
The Kood.
He is now a Marvel exclusive. He did a little bit during their Secret Wars Battle World stories. He did a little continuation with the X-Men, kind of Grant Morrison era X-Men story. And I guess it went so well that he's now exclusive with Marvel.
Which is a smart play on their part, I think. I was thinking about this a little bit over the last couple of days, because this was a news item that dropped a couple of days ago. I was thinking about this in as far as, so obviously, you've got the big two, and there is, my general philosophy is, you know, rising tide carries all boats. What is good for one is generally good for the other, but there's always been this rivalry between DC and Marvel. And it's not like you can, you know, it's not like Marvel is going to suddenly scoop up the rights to Batman. It's like, aha, we got Batman from you guys. That's not going to happen, obviously. It's not, you know, DC's not all of a sudden going to grab the Incredible Hulk. It's just never going to happen. So in lieu of being able to poach characters from the other team, I feel like the closest that you get to that is grabbing a creative, signing them to an exclusive deal and going, They're ours. Now, what do you got? And Kooter's tremendous.
True. And my apologies, because that art style, kind of very kind of Frank Whiteley-esque, I confuse him with Chris Burnham, who worked with Grant Morrison. This, Aaron worked with
Greg
Pak.
Yes, Burnham was the one who wrote. Yes, yes. Okay, he did Action Comics.
Yes.
He did Greg Pak's recent Action Comics run, which is fantastic. The art style is a little bit similar, though. And it does. It does remind me. It feels a little bit like 2 degrees removed from Frank Whiteley style.
Yes.
Yeah, so I totally get, I absolutely see where that happened.
And for me, I love continuity, even, you know, whether it's the Justice League of America, sort of everybody coming together and everything similar, or like in Marvel, you have your X-Men, you have Spider-Man, and they don't always like come together, you know, unless they're the Avengers. But with the art being across the board, it's going to feel more like this is their own universe to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what I as we're talking about, I loved his work on Action Comics with Greg Pak. I'm curious to see what he has in store for him over at Marvel. I don't know. I don't know if I want to see him do it on a solo title. Do I want to see him on a team title? Not exactly sure. Mm.
There are a few artists that if I see their name on a book, I almost don't care what the book is about. I want to go pick the book up because I want to flip through it and look at the pretty pictures.
But I feel like there are artists that are more well-suited and they who enjoy doing either solo titles or team books. Like George Perez, the more the merrier. He'll draw everybody and anything inside the panel. But somebody like Chris Samnee, maybe more of a solo character. You take him on a Daredevil or a Black Widow.
Sure.
Yeah, you can focus more just on one character. It's a little bit more his speed for that. Because it's easier for a writer to write. The Avengers come storming into the room, but it's a hard thing for the artist. Like, man, all right, I got to draw seven characters.
How big is the roster this month?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Which Spider-Person is on the Avengers now? Now there's like five Avengers teams. Which Avengers team am I writing?
That's right. Now we'll hop over to the DC side of the universe for the DC TV universe. YNR Young and Restless. In fact, Lucretia Lyons, she does the Restless wrap-up here on AfterBuzz TV, one of the affiliate stations here with Book Circle Online.
Thank you.
But one of the alums there, Susan Walter, she's joining The Flash there on the CW as Caitlin Snow's mom. Mm-hmm. Look at that. Mm.
So this is new. It's news. Gee, no kidding. New information. So it's called news. And it had never really occurred to me to go, yeah, I really want to meet Caitlin's mom. Yeah. But you know what? You know, to be fair, watching Arrow, it never really occurred to me that I would want to meet Felicity's mother either. And that is now one of my favorite characters on that show.
Yeah, Donna Smoke is fantastic. So I can only hope that Mama Snow will be as entertaining.
And then they can spin the two of them off. And they can do, like, they can get just, like, two more moms in the universe. And they can do, like, Sex in the City, but on CW in the DCU.
Well, I mean, Alex Kingston does play the Canary's mom. You know?
Why isn't this show in production right now?
It's like, wait a minute, brilliant idea.
That's season 3, Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah,
that's what that is. the moms are doing it for themselves there. I'm hoping because Donna Smoke, she was kind of irritating at first. It took me a while to really warm up to her character.
Well, I think it took a while for them to figure out how to use her as more than a joke character. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it took, she had to be around for the better part. I think it was better part of a year before they really started, you know, opening that character up a little bit and like, oh, hey, there's the real human being under the surface, very ditzy, shallow, fun lady. And there's actually a real beating heart there.
She makes Captain Lance smile, which rarely ever happens.
It's like, and that man needs to smile, man. Like, he does bad.
Yeah, I don't know. I would agree with your earlier assessment, though, Lex. I don't know if I have any interest. Do I really want to see Caitlin Snow's mom? She's not that interesting that I want to see, like, you know, Cisco. All right, I'll see more of his family, but Caitlin, I'm cool. Just knowing that Ronnie died, that's cool. We'll leave it with that.
So that's a cautious optimism from Lex and a hard boo from Frank.
Yeah.
Now, as we're talking about other DC TV Universe shows, we've also got on Legends of Tomorrow, we've got Matthew McCall and Sarah Gray cast as Commander Steel and Stargirl in Legends of Tomorrow.
Could you imagine having this conversation even a year ago?
That's fun. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, Legends of Tomorrow, they're just like, who can we get? Who can we just throw in here? You know, I like that, though. It's like, all right, just throw them out there.
When
just
I saw that tweet there. Of the pick for the Justice Society of America on logo on the table, come on now. Come on.
Yeah, the logo is, like, perfect.
I am just, this is just hitting me in my sweetest of spots for this. I am so excited. But that also means I'm building myself up for a colossal letdown when things invariably go south.
Yeah, because to me, I'm just curious about John Wesley's ship's contract. Is it here? Because if we are having the Justice Society of America, well, maybe Jay Garrick can come over to Legends of Tomorrow sometime.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
I am just so excited at the idea that about a year from now, like tweens across America who really before their only interest in any of this was like, yeah, I watch CW. I like, you know, the Pretty Little Liars, the CW.
That's Freeform.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Whatever. The vampire whatevers that's on CW. I like all that stuff. That same group of tweens about a year from now is going to be able to have a conversation about the Justice Society of America. That, like, is so trippy and awesome and exciting to me.
But until I see, it's not going to be the real Justice Society until I see Alan Scott.
Yeah.
I got to see Alan Scott. Otherwise, it's not real. It's
like,
not real.
Who knows? Like, what's the deal with who they can use for the shows?
Jeff Jones.
But you know what? Superman is showing up on Supergirl, which means we are that much closer to getting all of the big, whatever iteration, the big heavy hitters, more of them onto these shows.
Yeah, and I'm not so caught up, much like with the with Outcast in terms of its TV show and its comic book mediums there. I just want the characters. And I am so, as a fan, I'm easily able to make those distinctions. Like, this is a TV universe. This is a film universe. This is a comic book universe. And the characters may not be, they may not look the same. They may not behave the same. But I'll take it just for the universe that it is in, the medium that it is in. Let me tell those stories with all the resources that are possible in these fantastic universes you've created.
Yep.
Yeah, because I agree. I mean, Gotham certainly takes a lot of liberties, but for the most part, it's working.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to meet these characters.
And as a fan, you have the right to just like, you know, okay, that's an interpretation I don't particularly care for, so maybe I just want to enjoy it and I'll just stick to reading Gotham Central instead.
Yeah. But that's the thing, is like the more people that are watching these shows, and then the more shows they're going to make. The more shows they make, well, probability of odds says not every single one is going to be amazing, and not every single one is going to be exactly your cup of tea, or maybe wouldn't have been the way you chose to adapt it, but they're just going to keep making more, which means we wait a little while. Like, for example, eventually this iteration of the DC Universe on TV will slowly draw to a close, right? Arrow's going into its fifth season. Most shows don't last too many more seasons than that, so at some point in the next couple of years, Arrow will probably wrap up, and maybe this iteration of the universe will continue, and he'll continue to be around. Maybe all of these shows wrap, and then what ends up happening inevitably is, give it a couple years, if that, new universe starts to crop up in its place, and we get whole new versions of all these characters that, hey, maybe if you don't like this version, you're real mad that Oliver is dating Felicity and not Laurel. Well, wait a little while, and they're probably going to give you a version of this story that is exactly what you want. And that's like, what a magical time to be alive.
That's true. I mean, for me, all that matters is just tell the story well. Just tell the story well. Give me interesting concepts, interesting characters, and I don't care if you necessarily follow canon of what these characters are supposed to be. As long as you introduce Alan Scott, and that's the important thing.
Well, and like, would you agree that, and like, I agree completely. Would you agree it's far more about the core, just keeping the core of the character intact?
Yes.
And within that, you can do pretty much anything. I think that's the problem a lot of people had with some of what DC's doing in the movies right now, is that they're moving away from the core of what the character is.
Yeah, like Superman doesn't kill people. Those sort of things.
But it's more of a context. Yeah, but anyway, it's that. It's just keep the core of the character consistent, and I think people will forgive you for taking a lot of other liberties. And if they don't, again, it's like just like wait a while.
Yeah,
there's gonna be
somebody
more. Just like wait a while. There's gonna be more stuff.
And one other character that, as we talked about, Stargirl being entering the series, that's probably one of the newest creations that kind of stuck around the DC universe. Jeff Johns created her, kind of based on his sister that had passed away at an early age. Kind of was an inspiration for that character. She had a great series that Jeff Johns was one of his first forays writing a solo title for DC Comics, Stars and Stripes. If you get a chance, there's two trade paperbacks of that out. It's great. It's a great story right there.
That so I have a question that is directly related to what you were just saying about how this is a pretty recent creation that they're now porting over to the show. Is there one character, like, quick, don't even think about it off the top of your head, one, like, a real modern creation, fairly new, like, very, like, you know, within the last tops within the last 20 years, say 15, that you would desperately want to see either on a show or in a movie from, let's say, the DCU?
I would the first one that pops in my head would be Black Lightning.
Okay.
I love Black Lightning. That would be cool.
Do you have one?
She was already made into a movie because I, you know, being that Harley Quinn maybe started out on an animated show, I was like, oh, that'll be so fun. And, yeah.
For me,
it's
a little weird. Professor Pig. I so badly want an entire movie where Batman, Ben Affleck Batman, fights Professor Pig. I feel like I need that. Because he's just the craziest. and it's great.
Oh, if we could have villains, onomatopoeia then. I was thinking heroes. Yeah.
I want onomatopoeia on Arrow and like in that universe.
And they've talked about it, so it's a possibility.
Now, something else that's out there is hopefully the truth. Will we getting a chance to extend finding that search for the truth? Because X-Files is in significant talks. Fox TV is in significant talks with X-Files, David Carter, David Duchovny, Gillian Anderson, and Chris Carter to come back for another season. Season 11, if you will.
So the three of us have spent a lot of time talking about the X-Files together. I grew up on the X-Files as we talked about because we did the AfterBuzz after show for the revival, the limited revival series. One of the things I talked about is the earliest visual memory that I have is from the opening credits of the X-Files, and it's that white silhouette body like falling down. So this show is coded into my DNA pretty hard. I am always, and I think will always, be ready and willing for more X-Files. Having said that, I the way they left it, I would like them to just ignore the way they left it in the event series and do like a slight soft reboot maybe so that we don't have to address any of that.
To me, that's the part that made me so mad, is they set up like this stuff with William so much, and then to not explain it, as I, you know, if you watched me drunk on the after show of the finale, you'll see I was very angry about them just setting up so much and then crap in the bed. I mean, it was like, seriously?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, Chris Carter created the show, certainly. He's invested in it as well, but I think it's just his contributions to the show, I just feel, were the weakest parts of this revival. And I feel like just keep your name on the title, but Chris, you feel free to step away and let the reins go there. I'm sure there are certain people that are actively involved when the show first came out, as well as fans that grew up watching the show and love a chance to kind of contribute to tying a story in the X-Files universe with these characters.
Yeah, we'd much rather see more, you know, Glenn Morgan, Darren Morgan, James Wong, hell, even let's get Vince Gilligan. Let's do it. You know,
Vince Gilligan, I think they talked about, and we talked to Glenn Morgan, I think, too, there was some conversation about maybe trying to get Vince Gilligan involved, but he's working on Better Call Saul, and schedules didn't permit. I totally get why they didn't expand the creative roster for this iteration. It had a very, like, getting the band back together feel, so it's, let's see whose schedules we can work with that's, like, has been part of our core team, and let's use them. I feel like the more they keep doing this, and it was such a ratings hit for them, they'll keep doing them until no one's watching anymore. The longer they bring back the X-Files over and over again, the more opportunity we're going to have to see other storytellers and other creatives come in and put different spins on these characters.
Because I still think the concept and the characters work as well today as they did back when the series first aired.
Oh, yeah.
And just some of the nods to be able to show how times have changed from when the series first aired and just how what they did has changed so drastically. Even Mulder just having that kind of crisis of conscience in that fantastic episode that Darren Morgan wrote.
Yeah, that was my favorite. Yes.
And that too, the Mulder and Scully meet the Weremonster was so good that to me it justified every penny they spent on that entire revival. I thought that episode was that strong. That alchemy does still clearly exist then. So it's just about finding it, essentially.
Yeah, because to me, I would way more rather see episodes like that than these mythology episodes written by Chris Carter, as you said, you know, just didn't really pay off in the end. And that was just very frustrating. And you can tell that David and Gillian obviously want to have more fun like that because they obviously enjoy themselves more. And like David's tweet yesterday wishing Gillian Anderson a happy birthday. And he's like, hey, if you see Dana, tell her Fox says she might want to polish up the old bag soonest. And it's like he's very, you know, joking.
Can you picture Duchovny's face while he's tweeting that too? He's like,
and you know he was naked, or at least in the red Speedo.
Probably, and I hope he was also at a very fancy restaurant while he was naked or wearing a Speedo and tweeting and laughing to himself.
I don't know. I mean, and certainly I can't speak for them, but I would just like it in my head. Imagine when the two scripts come sliding in front of them, and when you've got like Darren Morgan's script, and when you've got the Chris Carter mythology episodes. Which one are they more excited to read and do?
Well, but too, like, you know, the mythology was never really the strongest part of that series, especially past a certain point. It started to feel like they were just making it up as they went along because they were just making it up as they went along.
Yeah.
Once you get to about a third, not even the halfway point of the series, it's really the standalone episodes. They do have a loose continuity that connects them, but the standalone episodes that are really the backbone of that show. I feel like you could almost jettison the mythology stuff entirely. At this point, I guess we gotta resolve William. And it'd be nice to see Doggett again. Like, where's that guy? But that aside...
Shooting Scorpion.
It's probably... Yeah. Oh, I heard shooting scorpions, and I was like, in his backyard? I get it now.
Let's show.
But those elements aside, I'd be perfectly happy jettisoning the mythology completely and just telling some one-offs with a loose continuity connecting them.
Yeah, please get rid of the mythology. Let's just tell fun stories, entertaining stories, just set in that X-Files universe. Oh, that's all I want. That's all I want.
I think we can all agree on that.
Look at that. Yeah. Oh, we've come to a quorum here. Woo! On the Comic Book Exchange. Oh, yeah. That's where we like to stick the landing on an episode there. So, as I said, well, that's going to do it for us in this episode. But come back next week. We're going to be breaking down the second set of six issues of Outcast. Seemed really convoluted the way I said that.
There you go. Yeah, the arc.
Yeah, the second arc of Outcast. Issues 7 through 12, or just in the second volume of the trade paperback right there. Volume 2. Of Outcast. We'll be breaking that down next week, talking all about it. We'll have the full panel reunited to break down everything Outcast. In the meantime, though, as I said, you can like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes, give us those 5 stars, like us on YouTube. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel, like, hop in the chat, share your comments there. Lucretia will have the chat open, she can answer, share your questions with us, we'll answer them throughout the course of the episode. And you can follow us on Twitter, and we can continue the conversation even after the show is done. So Lex, if they want to continue the conversation with you, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter and all over social media at TheLexMichael.
And since I'm Lucretia Lyon, you guys can always find me at LACRETIALYON anywhere on the internet, since there is only one.
And you can follow me on Twitter at HappyGoJackie. That does it for us for this episode of the Comic Book Exchange. Again, make sure you do your reading, everybody, because there's going to be a test at the end of next week's episode. Volume 2 of The Outcast, issues 7 through 12. We'll see you next week here on the Comic Book Exchange on Book Circle Online.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.